Good morning. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and Distinguished Lecturer at York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this, what is this? Today is the 19th, I think, right? Yeah, the 19th of March edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network in association with YCRadio.org. That's right. The York College radio station is tuned in to our proceedings, broadening the audience. I like to broaden the audience. I'm about broadening all the time. And so, again, this is a Women's History a Month edition. All of our shows will be that way for the next 2 weeks. And we have a great lineup this morning, which will feature Barbara Arnwine, attorney Barbara Arnwine, coming up in a minute, Reverend Kimberly Deathridge, and then finally, we're going to have someone who's going to talk about political prisoners as well, Dekai Kanoni Siddiqui. I'm not sure I have that name right, but she'll correct me when she comes on the air. But first and foremost, I want to thank our listening audience for those of you who have responded and have become WBAI buddies. I received a note from the programming manager the other day, or maybe it was the general manager, indicating that there's been a good response to Vantage Point in that regard, and we hope others will continue to do so. It is so vitally important that we keep WBAI not only alive, but thriving and growing. And, you know, there are growing pains, and there are humps and hiccups and issues sometimes, but let's keep our eyes on the prize, the bigger prize of the strategic significance of WBAI. And a way to, again, as has been promised, to reduce the number of fund appeal drives is to get a large number of people who become subscribers as WBAI buddies. And so I'm really delighted that people have been responding. I appreciate that so much. I'm a WBAI buddy. It is really very painless, which makes it good. Because once you sign up by a credit card or your savings account, it just happens. You don't have to think about it. It's done. You've made your commitment. It's there. And believe me, with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, we have a sustaining contributor program. And it is so good to know that we have people who are signing up. And we say, oh, if we do this much, it covers the rent. We do this much, it covers something else. It means that you have predictability in your budget. And so that's important. So let's step up to the plate. I hope others will do so today by going to WBAI, give to WBAI.org, give to WBAI.org. And what that really means is with as little as $10 per month, you can become a WBAI buddy. And there's a range of benefits that come with that, even at the $10 level. But you can go $25, $50, $100. You can do whatever you can afford to do. It's deeply appreciated. There's a tote bag that comes with it. There are also discounts with retailers that really make it very, very effective. It's really been well thought out, and it's very beneficial. There's discounts to events, all those things. So again, become a WBAI buddy. We'll be talking more about the big town hall meeting coming up in Newark, New Jersey on April the 3rd, from the mountaintop to the promised land, King's Journey for Economic Justice, a national town hall meeting focusing on Mayor Roz J. Baraka's quest to make Newark a model city, and also commemorating the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's mountaintop speech with special guest and keynote speaker, none other than Danny Glover. That's right, Danny Glover will be in town, actor, activist, and UN ambassador for the decade of people of African descent. That will be on Tuesday, April 3rd, 7 o'clock p.m. at the historic Robert Treat Hotel, 50 Park Place, Newark. We want to pack it out. There are people who are coming from all over the country, from everywhere. Business people, professors, and I mean scholars, investors, urban policy specialists, all over the country are coming to support Newark. That's big. All right, so we'll talk about that more later, but I'm getting word out right now because we want to pack the house with this town hall meeting, and it will be in the spirit of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, first up, joining us this morning is a dear, beloved friend who does such amazing work. I called her our champion, our voter protection specialist par excellence. I mean, she guards vigilantly to make sure that black people have the not only the right to vote, but that our vote is protected. And it's an uphill battle, but we know that we are in good hands, and we are in the hands of attorney Barbara Arnwine. Barbara Arnwine, welcome to Vantage Point.
Well, thank you, Dr. Daniels. It's always great to be on your show, Ron. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's you're very, very special. And as I said before,
you're the special one.
We'll talk more about this as we get into the show. But there are two things I want to accomplish today. I really want to share more about you and your work. But last week, and we'll get to this in the latter part of our interview, we had a caller, because this is our amazing Black women segment, talking about Harriet Tubman and the fact that she's not getting the exposure that our audience, or at least this member, thought we should have, and I kind of agreed. So I wanted you to come on and share with us about Harriet Tubman, but not only share with her the kind of commemorations that are taking place and different honors that are being bestowed on her and whatever. So let's get to it by, first of all, just talking a bit about your background. You hailed, when I first encountered you, really it was with the National Black Independent Political Party. There was this bad sister who was leading a delegation out of North Carolina. But is that where you're from?
No, I'm a native Californian, but I went to law school at Duke University and stayed in North Carolina and practiced for a number of years before going to Boston and then eventually here to Washington, D.C., where I practice now. But the MVIP, oh my goodness, I am just cracking up at all the calls for a Black independent political party that are all of a sudden resurfacing.
Right,
it is
right.
Amazing when you look at it. I mean, just think about how there is now a new clamoring for self-determination, for self-leadership, for, you know, an agenda that addresses our needs. Amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why this cross-generational leadership is so incredibly important. We have a generation of people who have almost no knowledge of certainly even the Gary National Black Political Convention, all of the work that was done through the National Black Political Assembly, and certainly that burst of energy around the National Black Independent Political Party. There's lots of lessons to be learned from that experience. So, you know, we hope we can make some connections with these young people and help them to understand, you know, how that can proceed. And I like it. I think there's just tremendous energy out there now.
Absolutely. And I was in Memphis not too long ago, and somebody came up to me and said that they have a whole stow of records from the MVIP and wanted to know what they could do with them.
Right.
So it's just, there's so much, but you're right, intergenerational leadership is critical. There is no movement that has ever been successful without intergenerational leadership.
Right.
And people get it wrong. You know, it's not that it's always been the wise elders. It's not always been just the young energy. It's been a combination of two. And that's why it's amazing to watch what's going on regarding the gun control debate right now, because we know that that's just a reflection of the Children's Crusade and all of the intergenerational leadership that came out of the Civil Rights Movement. So there's just so much to be said.
Right. So, Barbara Arnwine, when you look back on your life and your background, who are and what were some of the influences? Was it your parents? Were there particular leaders that sort of inspired you to become the civil rights champion that you have become?
Well, a couple of things. I always was blessed to have, you know, somewhere, somebody who would encourage me. Always. I mean, of course, there were a lot of discouragement, but I always was blessed. And also, I always say, you know, I was lucky. You know, things broke in my direction and in my favor, and a number of times, but I was, you know, really blessed. You know, my mom was a very amazing woman. She still is. My dad was, you know, a hardworking, very, very determined unionist, and he taught me a lot early in my life about, you know, organizing and about, he taught me a lot about, you know, race relations, and he and my mom were diametrically opposed in their views, but I learned so much, you know, from the two of them, and I just had an extended family of uncles and aunts who were determined to, quote, make me out of something, even though I was one of 12 children.
Mm.
You know, yes, I come from a huge family, And my mom was one of those women that was so amazing in the neighborhood that everybody called her mother. And
oh, yeah.
she would bake sweet cakes and all kinds of things and, tea cakes, and people would come to our house all the time. So I always grew up in a large, large family environment. Environment too.
It's interesting that tea cakes, that reminds me, goodness gracious, tea cakes.
Tea cakes, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
I
remember.
People would line up around the block for my mother's tea cakes.
Right.
That woman could cook and still can cook. But that's one skill I didn't get as well. But she definitely did. I had a lot of discouragement, as I said, professors, teachers, principals, everybody telling me what I could not do, who I could not be. And I was just blessed that there were some people who would counter that. I was blessed that, I was lucky. I sent my application to go to Upward Bound. It ended up in regular admissions, and I got admitted to college. Mm. These are the kinds of things that, who knows what would have happened but for, right? So I take a very strong view in life about, opening doors, providing opportunities, encouraging, the youth, fighting against all the negativity that's out here, and really, really, just affirming people and affirming the quest, especially those who are justice-minded.
Right. I just written a piece, a fairly extensive piece. I'm so much in the weeds these days that I don't write as much as I used to do, but I have cranked out a piece, particularly around the Martin Luther King observance that's coming up, around expanding the public space and culture of rights. And, you mentioned Upward Bound, and I referenced the fact that we have retreated so far from the time that you had robust public programs that black young people, but young people in general, could take advantage of. And Upward Bound was one of those programs that were available, that is no longer available out there in terms of people getting an opportunity to grab hold of something that would give them, upward mobility and a way to move out of their circumstances in a positive way.
Well, as I've grown in knowledge, one of the things that I really have come to understand a lot better is the nature of white structural racism in our society. And the reality is that because everything is structured for our subordination as black people, and everything is structured for, white, supremacy and white advantage, that the only way you can really break and dismantle that cycle is by having what you call active interventions.
Right.
And active interventions, as we've seen in other countries, are actions that absolutely are designed to stop and to interrupt or disrupt, the structural process. And so it really is important to have these kinds of programs. It's very important to take on these major questions of reordering justice, reshaping society, giving people advantages that they have been disadvantaged towards, all of these things that are critical. And our society is definitely in retreat in that regard, but I think it's very, very important that black people are also beginning to raise even more vocally the question about reparations and other reparatory and transformative justice.
Right. Now, what inspired you, or why did you choose to go to law school?
I was blessed. I met a really amazing lawyer, Harold Sanders. I had never really, really, really known much about black lawyers. I had only met one other black lawyer in my life, and Sanders was, this Rhodes Scholar, Harvard, educated black lawyer who was hired by our universities, because all the Claremont colleges where I went to college, we're in fight. We're having a huge dispute over our Black Studies Center, of all things. So it was dear to me to make sure that this dispute was handled in a good way. And he was looking for interns, and I volunteered to be his intern. And I learned how to, he told me that, I had a propensity towards the law, and that I should consider being a lawyer. And I had never considered it. I mean, I was on a total CRE-oriented, business school-oriented, program. Those were the only things I was thinking about. Either I was going to go to Wharton or I was going to go to Brown. I was going to either be a professor or I was going to be an economics major. It never, ever occurred to me that that there could be, an alternative in the law, especially for Black women. So when he encouraged me, I literally went to the school that day and asked about, what did I need to do to become a lawyer? And they told me I had to take the LSAT, and that this was the last day I could apply for it.
Oh, my goodness.
To make that particular cycle. Like I said, I've been lucky, right? Some people say I've been blessed. But it's just true. It was the last available day to sign up, and I did. And I took it sight unsound. I never opened a book, didn't know anything about how to prepare for an SAT, didn't even know there were preparation courses, books, nothing. I just took it cold, went into a room with 300 people. There might have been five to ten women, period, of all races. I think I saw a couple of brothers, and that was it. And when I came out of law school, I was the only person in my class. And let me be very clear, I went to Scripps College for Women, which is a predominantly white school. I was the only person in my class who went straight into law school.
Mm. Wow. That was incredible. Like you said, what an amazing journey, and obviously you did well on that test the first time, which speaks to your genius.
Well, I did.
The Motep syndrome.
I did okay. I mean, I'm amazed. I did okay.
All right.
But I did nothing close to what I did on the TREs. But I did okay, and I had good grades. And I was blessed to have those. Considering that I spent a lot of time in protest. When I was at colleges, it was not, very loved by my professors.
I heard that. We all kind of went through some of those experiences, I'm sure. Now, you had a very outstanding tenure at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law, one of the most prestigious public interest law firms or legal organizations in the country, and then have now gone on to create a new organization called the Transformative Justice Coalition. Talk to us about the vision and mission of your new organization.
Well, the purpose of the Transformative Justice Coalition is to bring organizations together to work on issues and problems where there are gaps in our field, and to look at these issues not just as, how do we band-aid them, but to really look at what are the transformative answers, remedies, systemic changes that are needed, to look at everything from a systemic viewpoint. How do you address this monster of, white structural racism? How do you educate about it? How do you, how do you break it? And, of course, our focus is on voting rights.
Right.
Very strongly, we're very much into voting rights. We're also very strong around Black women, the advocacy for Black women and girls. And we also, do amazing work around policing reform. And when I say policing reform, let me be very clear. I say policing restructuring.
It sounds like you've been talking to Ron Hampton.
We can't reform this system, huh?
I said, it sounds like you've been talking to Ron Hampton.
Ah, yes, Ron Hampton's a friend of mine.
Ron Hampton does not like reform. He does like restructuring. Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, you can't reform something that's, that's basically, you don't throw honey on something that's, sour. that's absolutely already desecrated. There's no way to look at this policing system and its origins, its operations, and not to realize that its role is to continue the subordination of African Americans. And, and half of the people they kill who are black, are really killed for insubordination of cops. And, or I call it insubordination of white supremacy. And so it's very, very important for us to have a real strong role in looking at this. And that's why I believe one of the biggest answers to policing in our country is to actually depolice, is that we have too many police.
Right.
Right. Quite contrary to what politicians will tell you.
That's right.
We have too many, and that we have too few counselors, too few societal interveners, which is what's needed instead of all of this policing, including the notion of arming teachers and more school resource officers. No, none of that.
I heard that. Give us a quickie, because I want to spend a few minutes talking about Harriet Tubman, on the status of our right to vote. Not our right to vote, but the status of voter protection, of these programs that are designed to sort of dismantle the vote. You've been swimming in a very difficult environment, but it seems that there are some victories, maybe some defeats. But what is the status of this onslaught that's been coming at trying to use all kind of programs, voter identification programs and everything, voter ID programs and everything, to sort of diminish, dilute the black vote?
Well, we are in the seventh year of the modern era of massive voter suppression. In 2011, April 2011, when I created the Map of Shame to educate people about this new age of voter suppression that came when 25 million people who had voted in 2008 did not vote during the midterms in 2010. And you had this massive shift in so many state legislatures where you have, the vote right now, coming up in this midterm, you have all these states like Michigan and others where, the entire legislature is up for vote. And people don't vote midterm. They vote for president, but they don't vote midterm. And these state legislatures, as soon as they got into power, they said, we're going to cut off the right to vote for all of these, African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, Asians, youth voters, students, because they vote for too liberal. They just put together what I call the crosshairs. They put together targets, and they started passing all these horrid laws. As emergency legislation. By April of 2011, they had only been in office since January 1st. By April of 2011, there were already 40 states that had something like 100 laws, voter suppression laws, pending. That's how bad it was. Mm. That's how coordinated it was. That's how much the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, had gotten involved in this whole process of moving these laws quickly. They were almost identical from state to state. And it was just clear that we had a new, onslaught, a new assault, on the African American, on the Latino, and on these targeted communities' rights to vote. And so when I started talking about the Map of Shame, literally people told me to hush my mouth. Mm. They told me, don't you dare talk about voter suppression. That's a voter conspiracy theory. The Dems don't want to hear this. After all, President Obama just got elected. This is not the narrative people want to hear. And I said, no, this is the truth. This is what's happening. And if we don't deal with it, we're going to find ourselves losing millions of votes. And nobody wanted to listen. And it was an upward battle. But fortunately, truth has this, as you and I know, truth, what did we say? The crush to the earth shall rise again.
Truth comes to earth, shall rise again.
Had this, but we've always been. It had its power, and people started listening. And fortunately, by 2012, you know, this message of the new era of voter suppression started taking off. And I was very lucky that Melissa Harris Terry and others, you know, like her, you know, brought me on the TV shows and allowed me to really drumbeat. And I, you know, in that period of time, Ron, I literally went to and spoke at between 2011 and the end of November 2012. I spoke at 200 conferences to thousands of people, educating them about what was happening. And I find it hilarious now, hilarious in a disgusting way, that all the books on voter suppression, they just leave me out.
That's something.
You know, I don't exist. It's like everybody just, quote, discovered voter suppression, you know, right, their own. And it's interesting that it's all white men who have, quote, written the books. We're going to change that up. And, you know, really tell this story, because the story needs to be told correctly. We need to be able to analytically look at what's actually happening in a right way that brings about the changes so that people can have the right to vote without all of these impediments.
Right.
So what we want to do is to, you know, fight. So one of the things, you know, that I've been involved in is training African-American millennials, young people from the ages of 17 to 35, to be advocates, to go out into their communities and actually be these amazing voting rights advocates. And I love the almost 70-something people we trained already. We're about to go into Memphis during this MLK 50 week, and we're going to train another 100 people. And we're going to keep training people all year, all the way up until, you know, September. We're going to continue to train these voting rights advocates.
Right. Well, we only have a little bit of time left, so I don't get beat up by my audience. Say a word about the great Harriet Tubman, and questions like, is her statue in Statuary Hall, a stamp, any kind of commemorative things that, in fact, are happening around Harriet Tubman?
I encourage every black person, every parent, father, mother, every person who can read, who can independently research, to read up on Harriet Tubman. She is amazing. And this is a woman who was, she said she was an Asante Linux from Ghana, what is now known as Ghana. She, her mother was Harriet Ritt Green. Her dad was Ben Ross. He was a woodsman. Her mom was a cook. And if you know, she was born Araminta Ross. That was her name. But she changed her name to Harriet when she was older, when she was married, in honor of her mother. And people think it might have been in honor of an aunt, but obviously it was her mother. She also took a lot from her mom. You know, people don't realize that her mother actually threatened to kill and to harm her quote, slave master, her owner, because he was trying to sell, he had already sold three of her daughters and tried to sell her youngest son, who was named Moses, by the way. And when people talk about Harriet Tubman being called the Moses of her people, and talking about that name was given to her by William Lord Garrison, whatever, actually, her brother, her youngest brother, was named Moses, and her mother threatened to kill the slave owner when he tried to sell her son. And she threatened him so bad that he decided not to try to sell the son. He decided not to. And because of her amazing leadership. So she learned a lot from her mom. A lot about resistance, a lot about, you know, doing things. What is amazing about Harriet Tubman is that most people don't realize she was a beauty. If you read The Escape Notice, she's described as, you know, strong, you know, physically strong. She's also described as fine-looking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, you know, new folders come out of her from the late 1860s, right after the Civil War. You see that she was petite. She was 5 feet tall. She, you know, was extremely creative. She was strategic. She's the first, not only, you know, people know about her going in and helping to rescue folks, you know, from slavery to help, you know, people to escape, but people don't know that in a, that she was a songstress. She was singing. She created, you know, all kinds of songs. Her favorite song that she was singing all the time was what? Go Down, Moses.
Go Down, Moses, yeah.
And she, you know, was very, you know, she was, of course, disabled in the sense that she had been hit back in the head, the iron weight by, you know, a slave owner. And that she, you know, did that. But what I find amazing about it, and most people also don't know, besides being a cook and nurse during the Civil War, she is the only woman in the entire Civil War who leads a regiment of soldiers.
Wow.
And she leads them in the Kobachi ferry raid, where she lifts the three steamboats to navigate around the mines. And she, they're able to, you know, capture all of this, you know, wealth, you know, from this area in South Carolina. But more importantly, they rescue 700 people who were enslaved. They take them on the boats and bring them out of slavery.
Right.
During the Civil War. That right. was her.
Right.
She was the captain, the general of that raid.
Amazing woman.
People don't understand her.
Right.
This is an amazing woman.
Right. Well, we've run out of time in terms of the amazing woman, and we hope to bring you back and talk more about Harriet Tubman. But before we conclude, please give people information about how they can be in touch with the Transformative Justice Coalition.
Yes, please, Colt, you can find us at tjcoalition.org. TJCoalition.org. You can find us on Twitter at TJC_DC. We're also, we head up the Voting Rights Alliance. So if you look up Voting Rights Alliance on Twitter, you'll find us. We also head up the African American Women in the Law Conference. So find us on Twitter, Facebook, under those designations. And where we have a Facebook page as Transformative Justice Coalition. So thank you, Ron. Just thank you for having me on your show. Thank you for all that you do to fight for, you know, justice for our people, your brilliance, your scholarship. Just thank you for everything and your leadership.
Well, we appreciate having you so much, and we'll see you down the road a piece on this Freedom Road.
All right now.
All right. Thank you so much. All right, Attorney Barbara Arnwine, our first amazing black woman. We're running a little bit over time. Coming up next will be the Reverend Kimberly Deathridge, the senior pastor at St. Mark Amy's AME Church. We're going to take a quick break, however, and come right back with Pastor Kim.
I am she, making rainbows in coffee cups, watching fish jump after midnight in my dreams. On the stove, left front burner is the stew already chewed, certain to burn as I dream of waves of nothingness. Floating to shore, riding a low moon on a slow cloud, I am she who writes the poems. Childhood remembrances are always a drag if you're black. You always remember things like living in Woodlawn with no inside toilet. And if you become famous or something, they never talk about how happy you were to have your mother all to yourself and how good the water felt when you got your bath from one of those big tubs that folk in Chicago barbecue in. And somehow, when you talk about home, it never gets across how much you understood their feelings as the whole family attended meetings about Hollydale. And even though you remember, your biographers never understand your father's pain as he sells his stock and another dream goes. And though you're poor, it isn't poverty that concerns you. And though they fought a lot, it isn't your father's drinking that makes any difference, but only that everybody is together, and you and your sister have happy birthdays and very good Christmases. And I really hope no white person ever has cause to write about me, because they never understand black love is black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy.
All right, we're back. That was Nikki Giovanni. Thanks again to our chief announcer, Michael G. Haskins, dropping in an appropriate piece as we continue our Women's History Month's programming with amazing black women. And, of course, Barbara Arnwine, who you've just heard, is a bad sister. We could keep her on. We were just getting into Harriet Tubman, her discussion about Becca. I got to go back and read some more about Harriet Tubman because she opened up some things that I didn't know about Harriet Tubman. And again, we thank so much our listener who called in to say we needed to focus on Harriet Tubman. And we'll do more, actually, on Harriet Tubman, who is, you know, there's a lot of stuff about her in the state of New York, and we need to know more about that now. Joining us now is, again, Reverend Kimberly Dethridge, attorney, really, Esquire. And she's the pastor at St. Mark AME Church, and by disclosure, she's actually my pastor. And one of the reasons I wanted to have her on, I talk all the time about the fact that there are people around us who are amazing, but we don't really know their stories, and we need to talk about her stories. And she delivered a sermon a few weeks ago, and she was just talking about her background. And I was saying, look, we're here in this church, and all of this wonderful stuff, all of this incredible pedigree of activism and organizing and her background, and we just kind of sit on it sometimes. And I want to bring it out so people can see it and understand who we are as a people. So, Pastor Kim, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you. Welcome and good morning.
Well, I want to start off by just asking you a bit about your background. And by the way, I think it's correct to say that you are the first woman to be a pastor at St. Mark. And it's how many years now? About 100-year history now?
190.
190?
Yes. When I came, it was 183.
Okay.
Now it's about 190.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a distinction in and of itself. So, I know that you expressed that you were from Louisville, right? What was it like growing up in? I think that's what you said. What was it like growing up in Louisville, Kentucky?
Actually, the poem that was right before me with Nikki Giovanni is a great example. I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, during the 60s and 70s, and in a very tight knit family. My parents, Catherine and James Dethridge, were first generation college students, and while I was growing up, they were finishing up school. And it was a wonderful childhood. My grandparents had farms, and on weekends we would go to the farm and be a part of an extended family. And so Nikki Giovanni talked about love and how love is wealth. And for sure, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, surrounded by a family who loved you and nourished you and cared for you and told you how beautiful and how wonderful you were and that you could be anything that you wanted to be despite what was going on around you.
You know, that's interesting because and our previous guest, Barbara Arnwine, said the same thing, you know, in spite of particularly in many instances, white teachers telling us that we couldn't be, you can't do this, you can't do that. There's a certain passage in Malcolm's autobiography where he was told that he could not. And this person was trying to be kind, I guess, in some ways, but you'll never be able to do that. But having parents and family, it seems, is very important to people who are encouraging, sort of a nurturing, loving environment. And she pointed to that as well. And it seems that was foundational to you.
Yes. In fact, growing up in the South during the 60s and 70s, there's a lot of instances where you're confronted with who you are. But I recall one incident when I was in fifth grade and my teacher, white Jewish teacher, spoke to us about the Vietnam War. And I just raised my hand and said Vietnam War was a terrible war. And she was talking about how great it was, and I was like, no, it's not. And from that discussion, I was punished, you know. My parents were called, and the next day in school, I see my father and my mother at the door. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm going to get in trouble because they had to take a day off from work. And the teacher told the class, I'll be back. And my parents said, no, we want our daughter in the discussion also. And we went to a room, and the teacher told my parents what happened. And one of the things that I always remember is that my father and my mother, you know, saying that we teach our daughter to have a voice. And one of the things that we don't want you to do, if she's out of line, if she's disrespectful, then she deserves to be punished. But for speaking her mind and telling what she believes is the truth, my father said to the teacher, don't break her spirit. I'll always remember that.
Right.
You know, when times get rough, you know, I think to myself, my father's words, don't break her spirit, and my mother's support.
Right, right. Well, Louisville, Kentucky is the home of one of the most famous people in the history of these United States of America and the world. He was once known as the Louisville Lip. He came up as Cassius Clay and became Muhammad Ali. Did you and your family have interaction with Muhammad Ali?
Not. My father may have, because they went to the same school, Central High School. And at the time, Central High School and Lincoln Institute were the only two black high schools in the entire state of Kentucky. That blacks could go to. I believe my father knew Muhammad Ali. But Muhammad Ali, you know, was everybody wanted to be Muhammad Ali.
Right.
And he was a part of every household. My parents, we had boxing gloves. We had a boxing ring in the house. My brothers and I would pretend we were in the ring being Muhammad Ali, you know. And we had Muhammad Ali Day.
Right.
You know, when he won that last fight, I can't remember which one, but I was in ninth grade, and the entire city had the day off to celebrate Muhammad Ali.
Right. I remember when you were, as part of your introduction and your discussion on the sermon you had delivered a few weeks ago, you talked about having the privilege of being in the company, I think it was Angela Davis that you talked about, that your parents interacted with her and whatever. So talk to us about that. That's a rare kind of opportunity. Not every person has had that kind of experience.
Well, growing up, my cousin, Judy Smith, was the, her husband, Ben Simmons, was the president of the Black Panther Party in Louisville, Kentucky. And sometimes they would come, Ben Chavis, you know, he was at the house, and I was through Cleaver, some others, and they would come to the house and just talk, and we were young, and so my mother didn't really want us, but you know how as kids you sort of used to be quiet and not speak and then
sit behind the couch.
right. And so that way we were able to hear and see what was going on. And I could never understand why the things that they were doing would cause such an uproar. You know, the Black Panthers, as you know, they were about equality. They were the ones that did the free lunch program. They were the ones to first talk about universal health care. And so all these persons were college students. They were at the house. They were studying. They were in school. You know, my cousin's husband, Ben Simmons, was at the University of Louisville. They were all smart. They were all brilliant. And they were all just fighting for civil rights and equality. And, I got to witness some things that made me say, you know, when I grow up, I want to be an attorney and I want to fight against injustice and whatnot. And I remember a time when they were hunting, the police was hunting down my cousin's husband, who was the president of the Black Panther Party. And they were at my aunt's house in the country, and they got a tip that the police were on their way. And so he ran out the back, and it was pouring and raining, and this is the early 70s. And the police just busted in the house and came in and busted down doors. And it's something that no one, you know, living in the neighborhood like that, you don't see stuff like that.
Right.
Helicopters, you know, looking for this one man. And I'm like, well, what did he do? He didn't do anything. And so he told us after the police had left, he told us, because we thought he was going to get captured. And it was raining, and my aunt in her backyard has this big field. And he was running from the and slipped and fell. And he said all he knew was, because if he got up and ran, they would see him. It was dark, it was raining. And he just laid flat in the mud with his face down. And one of the police officers stepped right on him. And he said he didn't move. And they searched and searched, and he said that was the longest day. He just knew he was going to die.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so the cops left, and they didn't find him. And I just learned a few days ago that my grandfather negotiated his surrender so that he would not be killed by the police.
Wow. Yeah, those stories are, you know, when you read the history of Black people in this country, there are far too many stories like that. You know, it's just, but it's important to share those stories, because it just shows the degree to which, though we've made significant progress in this country, we still, you know, have a long way to go. Where did you go to law school?
I went to law school at Boston College.
Okay. And what inspired you? Was that because you got the best offer? You had family there? What took you to Boston?
Well, when I was in 10th grade, we moved to Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
And my mother became a professor at Boston College. And so her and my father both were like, both of you have to apply. I have a twin brother, James, and both of you have to apply to school. And if you get in, you're going. Because it's free tuition. And so that's how I ended up at Boston College.
Right, right. Well, somewhere along the way, you talked about the inspiration and why you wanted to become a lawyer. But you're a minister, so we all know that somewhere there came to be a calling. And when did you get the calling, and how did you respond?
I believe I really got the calling when I was a young girl growing up. I believe that during the times when I would listen to sermons and look at even not just black discrimination, but gender discrimination, and didn't see any women in the pulpits or anything like that, and saw that it's like God was calling me to look beyond and to see that women are equal, that women are wonderful, that women are beautiful, and leading me to the book of Genesis, where God looked at all that God had made, male and female, and said that it was good, and to know that as women we have a voice. And just as years went by, God just kept calling me and calling me until finally, you know, it's hard to accept the call, because with the call comes a lot of responsibilities. And so I think it wasn't until I was about 28, 29 that I finally said, okay, Lord.
I surrender.
Right.
And so did you go to theological seminary? What path did that take you? Obviously ended up as in the AME church, but what path did that take? Did you go to a seminary, or just how did your theological training unfold?
Well, in the AME church, we have what is called the Ministerial Institute. And the Ministerial Institute is an institute in each conference of each district in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And in that institute, students looking forward towards ordained ministry are trained. And with that training in the AME church, every person who wants to be ordained as an itinerant elder in the African Methodist Episcopal Church must have a Master's of Divinity degree. And knowing that I wanted to fulfill the calling that God had placed on my life, I went to seminary to obtain the professional degree of a Master's of Divinity, and actually did while I was there. I went to Emory University, Candler School of Theology, and sort of minored in pastoral care with certificates in the Black Church and women. And so it was from there that I became active in the AME Church, active right. in women in ministry for the AME Church, began to start writing legislation for the church with respect to clergy sexual harassment.
Mm. And what has that journey been like as a woman? Because you talked earlier about your sense of having a calling because you didn't see women in the pulpit and so forth, which is common now. But certainly this is a relatively recent phenomenon within the last 50 years, actually maybe even the last 30 years, which has become very prominent. So what was it like coming up in a male-dominated profession and calling? So even though it was a calling, there was still this sort of male dominance. What was that like?
It was sometimes not easy, because sometimes it felt like you were always having to prove. You know, as we say, as a Black person, we have to be even better. Whereas a black woman, you have to even be that much better, because there's still discrimination. You know, there was sexual harassment. There was women may aspire, but sometimes I didn't, you know, we weren't taken seriously. I think now we've come a long way, but when you think about the AME Church and think about the fact that in 1787, you know, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones walked out of the St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church and formed the United African Society, and then in 1816, the African Methodist Episcopal Church was founded, and to go back in during that time, 1789, Jerina Lee asked to preach, be licensed to preach, because God had had a calling on her life, and initially she was denied, and then finally Richard Allen, hearing her preach, said, "I can't deny you your license." But, you know, that was the 1780s, 1790s. And look, Jerina Lee, it was a push to have her posthumously ordained at the 2016 General Conference. You know, women are still pushing to have parity within the church. We have 20 persons who are on the bench of bishops, and only two are women.
Right.
And even when you look at just last week with regards to the Church of England and their push to have women bishops, and it was denied.
Wow.
I mean, and so it's not that you're competing with men, which I think is sometimes the issue that is perceived. But what it is we want the same rights and the same opportunities as the men who are in ordained ministry. Women are second and third career. They have professions, major professions. We're doctors, we're lawyers, we're nurses, we're business persons, and yet when it comes time to if we want a pastor, we don't get the churches that are comparable to our degrees,
right,
and our talents and skills, as opposed to maybe a young man who comes out of seminary with no experience.
Right.
And so, you know, if you're single, there's discrimination. I mean, it doesn't mean that the church is not, you know, a good place.
Right.
You know, the African Methodist Episcopal Church has been a church that has been founded on activism and education, and that is what drew me to the AME Church when I came to New York to work for the Legal Aid Society.
Right.
I grew up Baptist.
Uh huh. All right. Well, finally, you're at St. Mark AME Church, and you're doing good work there. But talk to us about your vision and your mission for your ministry. How do you see your ministry at a church like St. Mark, or even if you were called elsewhere? What do you think are a AME a pastor should be doing these days in terms of pastoral work?
Well, I think that it's important to meet the needs of the many members in the congregation, and there's so many different needs, you know, social, political, emotional, mental needs of persons in the congregation. We have so many people, you know, you have people that are incarcerated, you have people that are going through various issues, you have teenagers, you have young adults, you have people in various stages of life. And one of the things is, especially in light of number 45, it's important for the church to go back to its roots with regards to activism and with regards to teaching our children and teaching our adults and helping and giving them knowledge with respect to what's going on around them in the world and how to navigate the world, sort of the social gospel of Jesus Christ.
Mm.
He went healing and teaching so that others might be made whole. And I think that that's important. It's not necessarily about constructing a physical building, so to speak, which we think about when we think of churches, but it's really about reaching people's lives and turning people around and helping them to see, to be empowered, and helping them to see that the condition that they live in is not the condition that they have to stay in. It's being a part of the community. St. Mark is a church which has a big building. And it's a building that is not going to be empty. It's a building where the community can come. It's a building where we have seniors and chess clubs and tax-free taxes and after school and things that would help to empower and keep our community together.
Right.
That's to know about, you know, that's why you are so important in our community. You keep us grounded. You keep help us to know what's going on and how it affects people of African descent. And I just want to say to you, continue and to do what you're doing with the Pan-African Unity Dialogue and with a Black World. You know, it's just so important. And our youth are listening. You know, and it's important to help them to understand. We may not always think that everybody's listening, but I believe that they are, and I believe that lives can be changed and people can be changed, and that we don't have to depend on outside sources to lift us up, that we lift up ourselves.
Right. Well, that's a fitting note to conclude, and let me just commend you because you really, really, really have placed a great emphasis on young people, and you always emphasizing young people, and I appreciate that as someone coming up also in a Baptist church, because it was in that church atmosphere that people nurtured me and kept encouraging me and whatever. And that's what we need. We've got to continue to believe in and nourish and encourage our young people to be new leaders and to share the leadership, share the torch, and take the torch into the future. So again, yeah. Reverend Kimberly Deathridge Esquire, attorney out of Louisville, Kentucky, by way of Boston, now in New York, we thank you so much for being with us this morning on Vantage Point.
Okay, thank you very much, and God bless.
All right, that's our second Amazing Women interview for today. We're going to take a brief break, and we come back. We're going to have our third one person for today, Daki Kinoni Siddiqui, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. If not, I will be stand to be corrected, but we'll take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Pull a sneaky right hand on Ali. Ali hanging on, getting away with it. Getting away with it. The left hand taken on the side of Ali's cheek. The left hook again on the side of the gloves. Right hand by Foreman was not effective. The right uppercut did bounce the head a little bit. His punches will not hurt Ali. Ali just takes him. Protecting his face at all times, does Ali. Foreman throwing more punches now. Maybe this could be the tactic of Ali to let the man punch himself out.
30 seconds left in round 8.
Very even fight. Ali, a sneaky right hand. Another sneaky right hand. This time he worked over the shoulder of Foreman.
Okay, we're back, and again, in tribute to Reverend Kimberly, Pastor Kim, as we call her, hailing from Louisville, Kentucky, some famous words from Muhammad Ali. Well, coming next now is, and she's got to correct me if I have mispronounced her name, I have Daki Kinoni Siddiqui. I hope that's right, but if not, she'll tell me how to pronounce it. Are you there?
I am, brother. Good morning. Thank you so much for the invitation.
And please pronounce your name for me, because I looked at it and I said, I make sure I say this right. Just pronounce it for me, please.
It's Daqui.
Daqui. Daqui Kinoni Siddiqui.
Kinoni.
Daqui. Okay, that's right. Daqui. All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Because I see you different places, see your face. I remember you at the big conference out on the West Coast at some point that a number of formerly incarcerated persons were there. You are just in the forefront of doing serious work around political prisoners and prisoners of war, and just dedicating yourself diligently to this cause. And so as we had this Amazing Black Women section, I said, I have to have you on the show, because I want you to talk about yourself, your background, but also we'll get into sharing about political prisoners and why this cause is so important. So let's start there. You're in New York now. Are you a native New Yorker, or do you hail from other parts?
I am, actually. I was born and raised in what we call, those of us from the People's Republic of Brooklyn. That's what we call it.
I know you were going to say Brooklyn.
yes. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. Lived out of across the river in New Jersey for a time when I was raising my children, who are now adults.
But yeah, and then I came back in the 1990s, early 90s, like 91, I came back to New York.
So what part of the People's Republic do you hail from, since it's such a big republic now? What neighborhood?
You know, that's always so interesting because that's what people often say. And when you're a child, you don't know this, but my mother moved a lot. So we were what people teased us. We were the gypsies of the family because we moved all the time. It was only as an adult that I realized that it was rent issues, eviction stuff, all the kinds of stuff that people struggle with today. So I can't lay claim to a particular part. We lived in Coney Island. We lived in Bed-Stuy. We lived in Brownsville. I mean, there's like every section of Brooklyn just about that I can remember living. We never lived any place for more than a year.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, that makes you cosmopolitan. You can claim all of the People's Republic. You got it all.
Right.
Well, talk to us about influences, because you obviously have taken up some causes and you're deeply and committed. What is it about your background that has you be the activist that you are? Does it come from your parents? Does it come from faith leaders? Where does it come from?
Well, I think one of the things that I know is women have always been central to my life. My grandmother had 8 children, 6 of them girls. And although I grew up with my grandmother and grandfather together, my mother and father were not together. And so when we went to my grandmother's house, because that's what we did all the time, and my mother and her sisters gathered together, it was always the women. It was very women-centered and women-led. I mean, it didn't mean that there weren't men around. It's just that as a young girl, I remember it being my aunts and my grandmother. And my grandmother mothered me much of the time. But it was always women-centered and women-led. So I grew up seeing that women took care of business and women took care of black women, took care of what needed to be taken care of. And so that was like in my formative years. And then I guess once I've been becoming an adult and reading about and learning about black women throughout the history of her story of time and just how they stood on the front lines of everything, doing all that needed to be done to protect their children and their family, their community, their nation, I'm inspired by that. When I read autobiographies or memoirs, the life stories of women like Ida B. Wells and Fannie Lou Hamer and Nina Simone, like, I'm inspired by those women who, known and unknown, who made a way out of no way to fight to create a better world.
Right. And that's not always, it's not always been easy, actually, for women in the movement, because there have been times, and maybe still are to some degree, when women were sort of not respected in the way that they should be in the movement. So did you encounter any resistance to becoming a part of the movement as you developed?
Of course. I've been in organizations. I'm a part of an organization now. I am the chair of the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee that was co-founded by Barbara Herman Ferguson and Yuri Kuchiyama and Gene Reynolds and other folks who were part of Malcolm's organization of Afro-American Unity. So I've worked with people in that organization and other organizations, but becoming like the chair of it, there have been some struggles that I know that I'm sure some of my comrades probably wouldn't agree, but I believe that some of the fight back that I had, not major, but some of the issues that had been resolved came about because the organization was transferred into the hands of a woman. But I haven't had such issues that it has prevented me or been serious roadblocks, but I do know that it is an issue that exists. We live in a misogynistic society, a patriarchal, so women's roles are always, you know, kind of like rendered invisible. But I don't, so I recognize that, and it's something that we deal with, but it's not something that has ever stopped me or something that it frustrates me at times, but it's not an overwhelming frustration.
Right.
It's just what we live with as, you know, black folks being rendered invisible, and then particularly black women being rendered even more invisible.
Right. Talk to me about your sort of your educational background. Did you go to school in Brooklyn, New Jersey? Did you do any higher education stuff? Just sort of flesh that out for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, the People's Republic of Brooklyn. I got married at a younger age, and as I said, I was living in New Jersey in Montclair for a number of years, and then I moved back to Brooklyn. And that's actually when I went to school as a divorce, I divorced my first husband, and became a single mother, and I moved back to what was familiar to me. And I went to school. I went to Mega Evers College, right there in Central Brooklyn, which was such an amazing, transformative experience, because at the time that I was there, they were amazing professors there, Zyla Highsmith Taylor, then known as Zyla Chandler, Don Quinn Kelly, Delridge Hunter. I mean, just amazing, Mary Umalu. They were just amazing people. Like, it was really, it was still in the throes of, like, it being a college that was created, that was born out of struggle,
right.
You know, named in honor of Mega Evers. So I would, you know, being in school then, that kind of helped to foster a different level of activism. Because when I lived in Jersey, I was involved with my daughter's PTA and doing things like that. But when I came back to New York, it created a different level of activism. So I went to, as I said, Mega Evers College, and then much later on, I went and got my master's at Queens College in public affairs, urban affairs, excuse me. And So my education, my college education was later on, which was probably good for me because I was very clear about, you know, like I needed to do this. And actually what I wanted to do when I was doing my undergraduate was go to law school. And my professors used to say, oh, you'll be great at law school because you love to read and you love to write. And I do love that. And my sister friend Joan Gibbs, we even laugh about it today because she used to always tease me and say, take some education classes because no matter what you decide to do, you'll always be able to get a job in school.
Right.
And I never paid attention to that, but I'm in education now.
Right. So talk to us about political prisoners. Why? How did you become engaged in this particular aspect of the Black Liberation Movement or the Human Rights, Civil Rights Movement?
So when I moved back to New York, back to Brooklyn, I met two folks up at Grant's Tomb. This is when Grant's Tomb used to be the place to go to listen to jazz on Wednesday nights, the Black Panther Collective. And I joined the Black Panther Collective, which was an organization made up of original members of the Black Panther Party and newer activists. And so part of that was carrying on the legacy of the Black Panther Party with the programs and political education and also visiting political prisoners. And so my first visit to a political prisoner was Albert Noah Washington, who is now an ancestor who died, we say murdered, by medical neglect up at Clinton Correctional Facility more than 10 years ago. And so that was my introduction. And, you know, through the Black Panther Collective, studying more and more of our history and really it becoming, I think it was always a part of me. I just, you don't know things until it really becomes unearthed because it's something that kind of like it becomes the epiphany. And that was the beginning of it. And that, then it was working with on behalf of Mumia, because at that time Mumia was on death row, and the Mumia Coalition was kind of new. So that was my introduction to political prisoners. And really learning about the history of the Black Liberation Movement from the 20th century, but because the Black Liberation Movement started from the kidnapping of African people,
right.
But really finding out what the Black Panther Party stood for, the 10-point platform and program, and that people truly sacrificed their lives and their freedoms and their families to work on the side of freedom and black self-determination, which is unbelievable. It was like, people need to know this. People need to know that there are people in prison because they fought so that children could eat breakfast in school, and that poor people could have access to health care.
So define for us, because our audience, you know, people who do this work all know the work and they know the people and so forth. But let's do a 101. How would you define, when we say a political prisoner? You may have already sort of given us a hint of that definition in your most recent, you know, when you were just talking. But define for us a political prisoner, and then what would you define as a prisoner of war? Let's take political prisoner first.
Okay. So a political prisoner is someone who was in prison for their political beliefs, their political writings, their political activities, association. Like Mumia being a political prisoner because as a journalist he exposed the state and its violence and injustices. And then, so that's a political prisoner. And then a prisoner of war is someone who took up arms and was involved in military action in the fight for liberation. Prisoner of war, and in this case we're talking about prisoners of war from the Black Liberation Movement of the 1960s and 70s, because there is a war that has been waging on Black liberation. As I said, it all goes back. None of these things are new. This started, Black folks fighting for their freedom began with the first kidnapping. So on those slave ships, on those slave plantations, and in every decade and century since then. So prisoners of war are prisoners because they engaged in actions for the liberation. And those actions, our resistance, Black resistance, has been criminalized. So the state calls them criminals, but they are people who have very clearly taken up what the Declaration of Independence says, that people have a right to freedom and people have a right to fight for that freedom and people have a right to resist.
Right.
So they did exactly what the Declaration of Independence says that people can do. That they did what the people in this country, the American Revolution, that's what they did. They took up arms against the British to fight for their freedom. Only they were not criminalized, but Black folks have been criminalized throughout history from Harriet Tubman on down to Assata Shakur.
Now, political prisoners, would you sort of talk to us about this movement and the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee? I assume it's part of maybe the Jericho movement. There's a huge movement around political prisoners that has been successful in getting, you know, some of the political prisoners out. But there are many who still are there. So would you sort of do a kind of roll call of some of the political prisoners who are still in that we should be working to try to free?
Well, we still have 13 members of the Black Panther Party who are in prison. Sundiata Okoli, who turned 81 this past January, he was court-ordered release by an appellate court in New Jersey to be released on parole. And the FOP in New Jersey appealed that decision all the way up to the New Jersey State Supreme Court. And so they won their appeal, and his parole was taken back to the parole board, and he had to appear again, and he was denied, and then he was given a 15-year hit, which means that they're telling him that you cannot come back to the parole board until you're 95 years old. Yes. So we're fighting for his release. We're going to be going to the governor for clemency. We're raising funds for his freedom campaign to fight that to you know, to for that appeal of that 15-year hit. We have Alonzo Bowers, who is in now he's in a medical facility in North Carolina, who maxed out of his time and was on his way out to prison, and he was labeled, quote, a domestic terrorist, unquote, by Alberto Gonzalez, and he's been held for the past 13 years without any charge or any conviction of any sort, because he served out his conviction sentence, and he's continuing to be held. We have Julio Montequin right here in New York State, who was 19 years old when he went to prison and is now in his 60s. Kamal Siddiqui, who is in an Atlanta, Augusta, Georgia, medical facility. The only reason why Kamal is, he was a member of the Black Panther Party. The only reason why Kamal is in prison is because the state, when they charged him with a 30-year-old crime that they had to drop charges, and there was no evidence against him 30 years ago. But when the FBI and the law enforcement offered him, at the time, the reward for Assata Shakur was $1 million. They told him that, we'll give you $1 million. And he said, I can't do that, both based on principle and the fact that she is the mother of my child. But they told him that if he didn't help them capture her, and the idea was for him to lure her someplace where they can then capture her, that if he didn't help them, that he would spend the rest of his life in prison. Actually, that he would die in prison. Mm. So they convicted him of this, of this 35-year-old crime, and he is doing 2 life plus, I think, 10 years. That's the same judge that sentenced Brother Imam Jamil Alameen, who is another one of our political prisoners, who when the sheriff was killed in Georgia, they said that the person who shot the sheriff was also wounded. However, when Imam Jamil Alameen was captured, he had no bullet wounds, but yet he was still convicted of the crime. So we, you know, there's 13 members of the Black Panther Party who still remain in prison. There's Ed Poindexter in Omaha, Nebraska, who was known as one of the Omaha Two. The other brother, Mondo Wilaga, he passed away in 2016 or 2017. I can't remember off the top of my head right now. So, and then we have white anti-imperialist political prisoners. We have David Gilbert right here in New York, Tom Manning and Bill Dunn. And so anywhere there is injustice, there is resistance, and where there is that resistance, there's the criminalization of that resistance. And so you're right, the Jericho movement came about because Herman Ferguson, Jaleel Muntakeen, who's in prison in New York State, and Safia Bukhari, who made her transition a number of years ago, who was also in the Black Panther Party, they created the Jericho movement to work for amnesty and recognition of U.S. held political prisoners and prisoners of war. And so the task for Jericho is to educate people and to support the political prisoners in any way. So sometimes that's raising funds for their campaigns, for their freedom campaigns. Sometimes that's visiting. Sometimes that's sending them money. Sometimes that is doing a medical campaign, such as what we often have to do for Robert Seth Hayes in New York, who is been in a 20-year battle with the New York State Department of Corrections over their unwillingness, reluctance, indifference, incompetence, whichever it is, to control and maintain his diabetes. So he's always either, you know, very, very high or very, very low with his sugars, which are life-threatening.
Right. Now, I had Betty Dobson on last week, and I know there was a program at CMOTEP this last Saturday. And there was an effort around Dr. Matulu Shakur, and his name you didn't mention. So
yeah.
What is his circumstance? I understand there is a push to try to, he's coming up for parole, and there's a push to try to get him out. So would you talk about his case?
Absolutely. So Matulu is up for parole again, and so we are asking people to write letters. A number of people have been convicted for crimes in association with the liberation of Asada and other conspiracy cases that the government have put on them. And so Mutulu has been in prison for 32 years, and he is going to be up for parole. And we know that that's a long battle with the parole boards across this country, because they're made up of prosecutors and law enforcement who really want to keep people in prison as opposed to releasing them. So we've been asking people to write letters of support for why people believe that Mutulu should be released on parole. And people can go to the JerichoMovement.com website, because I didn't name, as you said, all of the political prisoners, but there are ones from the Radical Revolutionary Movements of the 1960s and 70s, those 13 members of the Black Panther Party and a number of white anti-imperialist political prisoners. But then there are newer people. There are Muslims. There are people who have become politicized. There are, you know, earth protectors who are in prison. There are technology political prisoners. So the list is growing, because the injustices continue. And where, as I said, wherever there's injustice, there is resistance. So people can check out the JerichoMovement.com website to find out how and where to write those letters of support to Mutulu. So we're asking people, if you have an organization that can write a letter in support of his release, that would be really, really helpful. That would be incredibly helpful, because we need, you know, these people are coming back to our community, so we need, when they say that they shouldn't come home, we need the community to say, yes, we want them to come home. We need them to come home. They have something to offer. Not just to the community, but their families. I mean, we're talking about families who have done without their loved ones for 30, 40, and 50 years, simply because they wanted a better world for not just their children, but all people's children.
Right. And are there persons who have been released, perhaps, that are under assault because they've been released? Because this seems to be very punitive, very vengeful, very... And one understands at one level that there are families who feel that somehow, in some instances, their loved one was taken or whatever and all of that. And I'm not trying to belittle that or downplay that. But in a world of restorative justice, if one does the time, then that should be it. There should not be double jeopardy, triple jeopardy, and whatever. And there should not be a sense where some lives are more important than others. The Benevolent Police Association, these prosecutors and so forth, if there's a way in which if one of them, and heaven forbid that anyone is harmed or killed, we're not advocating that, at least I'm not. But on the other hand, you know, if you've done your time, you've done your time. But I understand there's these vendettas that are also unleashed against even some who have been released. Is there any instances about that you can share with us?
Oh, absolutely. Well, my husband, Sekou Odinga, came home in 2014, so that's a release. He's still on parole. Daruba Ben-Wahad came home after doing 19 years. And so when people are still on parole, they still owe time. So there are restrictions about travel. There's restrictions about where people can go and who they can be with, and they have to check in. And, you know, there's still... Even though people are released on parole, there are definitely still clear restrictions. And sometimes, depending on who the parole officer is, it can vary. But that's why, you know, there's some people who call it semi-freed, because while I'm not held behind a prison wall, I still have the chains on me. And the one thing I would like to say about our political prisons is that I'm always reminded of the state wanting to keep them in prison for resisting, because there are people who've been charged with similar so-called crimes, and they've come home. But what I see happens with our political prisoners, the people who resist, is that when they, in Senegal, on Gori Island, and those dungeons that they put kidnapped Africans in, the ones who were resisting and the ones who were the determinedly rebellious and refusing to go along, they would put them in a separate dungeon where they would put them there to die. And that's exactly what the prison system does today with the PBA and the FOP and these parole boards and these courts, is they put people in prison to die.
Right.
The same way they did our ancestors in those slave dungeons where they put our kidnapped ancestors.
Right. Well, this has been very helpful and very informative, and not enough is being done on these issues of political prisoners and prisoners of war. And I know the WBAI does its share, because I think there's a program actually on WBAI dedicated to these issues, but we have to find a way to do more. So please give us numbers, websites. You've given one already, but if there are other websites or phone numbers that you'd like to share now, please do.
Thank you so much, Ron, and I really appreciate you having us on here. So as I said, thejerichomovement.com is where you can find out more information about all of the political prisoners and their cases. And people can email me at mxcc519@verizon.net. That's mxcc519@verizon.net. They can call 718-512-5008, and when people don't know what political prisons have to do with them, just think about if your child has ever eaten breakfast in school, or if you've ever used a free health clinic, or gone to a food pantry, or a clothing drive, or have your child is tested, or babies are routinely checked for sickle cell anemia. These programs are the programs that are the legacy of the Black Panther Party. And so they have to do with all of our lives. So all of us benefit from the legacy and the sacrifice of our political prisoners. And so that's why we need people to get involved. And everybody, I always say this, everybody can't do the same thing or everything, but everybody can do something. It's writing those letters. It's sending commissary money. It's making a visit. It's a multitude of things. And if you don't know what to do, then you can email me and ask. And we can definitely put folks to work.
All right. All right. But my beloved sister, Dekwi Kanoni Siddiqui, we appreciate you spending so much time with us this morning. And I got to ramp up my brain to figure out ways of increasing the support, because this is not a good thing for people who have struggled and suffered for on our behalf, and it's not sufficiently on our agenda. So among other things that I'm trying to do, I'll be trying to figure out how to do more. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate that, and thank you so much for having us, Jill, and thank you to your listening audience for listening. The struggle continues, and we appreciate your participation in it in this way. Thank you so much, brother.
All right, thank you. All right, we're going to take a break and come back. And when we do come back, we're going to take your calls, and we're going to do your amazing black women, or your amazing black woman, if you will. You can call as we did last week, but we got to have certain conditions, certain criteria. So, you know, don't just call and say my wife or my mother. That's good, but say something about that person. For example, I think my wife is an amazing black woman. That's because she's an activist. She ran for governor as an independent candidate. She's an education advocate, and she's a faith leader. So that's what I'm looking for, those kind of things, not just because she's my wife. That's enough in and of itself. But in this context, we want to talk about their social engagement, their contributions, things that they have done that make them amazing black women, and there are many of them out there. So you can go to your phones now, begin to dial in at 347-335-0818, and we'll be waiting to take your call on the other side of this break.
Fellow Americans, we have looked in vain for the courage, the spirit, the character, and the words to lift us, to bring out the best in us, to rekindle in each of us our faith in the American dream. Yet all that we have received in return is just another smooth exercise in political manipulation, deceit and deception, callousness and indifference to our individual problems, and the disgusting playing of divisive politics, pitting the young against the old, labor against management, North against South, black against white. I have faith in the American people. I believe that we are smart enough to correct our mistakes. I believe we are intelligent enough to recognize the talent, energy, and dedication which all Americans, including women and minorities, have to offer. I know from my travels to the cities and small towns of America that we have a vast potential which can and must be put to constructive use in getting this great nation together. I know that millions of Americans from all walks of life agree with me that leadership does not mean putting the ear to the ground to follow public opinion, but to have the vision of what is necessary and the courage to make it possible.
Okay, we're back, and wow, what a program today. I've enjoyed it so much. I hope our listening audience has enjoyed it as we continue to feature amazing black women, because black women are underappreciated. This is not against anybody else, but, you know, it's the nature of the society we live in compels me to uplift black women because of the A Strong Historical World. That was Shirley Chisholm, Unbought and Unbossed, a candidate for President of the United States. I had the privilege of actually doing some work with her. And, of course, she hailed from the People's Republic of Brooklyn, and our dear beloved sister Yvette Clark has the seat that Shirley Chisholm once held. Also, on this issue of political prisoners, Hermes Ferguson is someone that I knew. The Center for Constitutional Rights actually took up his case and successfully, and had a chance to interface with him. And the Malcolm X Commemorations Committee, I support every year when they do their annual dinner that they have every year. But I've got to figure a way to do more. And we have someone who's a part of the Pan-African Unity Dialogue who I'm going to ask to continue to strategize with me. My thought is we need a national focused effort, and that it should be led primarily by prominent faith leaders who will come together and make the appeal, because this is absolutely vengeful, vindictive. It is the kind of punishment where someone has done their time, is called a domestic terrorist, and then are held like Guantanamo. You know, this is to send the signal. If you stand up and fight, this is what can happen to you. We owe it to our political prisoners, and I owe it to our political prisoners to do more. Because, but for whatever, I could be one of those political prisoners. You know, Larry Hamm, you know, and many people out here could be locked up for the work that we do on trumped up charges. But even if you're a prisoner of war, you know, the fact that people, you know, decided to resist in the way they resisted, it is our duty to defend them in a way that, frankly, we have not done. I have not done. I don't want to indict anybody else. I have not done sufficiently. So my contributions have been too puny, and hopefully I can muster enough energy to help contribute in a more robust way moving forward. The other thing I want to quickly just announce again, we have this major, or we are going to claim it as major, town hall meeting that's coming up. As the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, coming out of the State of the Black World Conference, which was supported by WBAI, one of the most amazing conferences ever. One of the action items was the effort to embrace Newark as a model city, aggregating resources from Black America to focus on Newark, focus on the history of Newark, focus on the legacy of Emeri Baraka, and now his son, a progressive mayor. Because I'm not just supporting anybody for the sake of supporting anybody. And this is not a political announcement, by the way. We're talking about the policies of progressive economic development programs that are being supported. And I must say, having heard them from the acting director of economic and housing development, Camelo Garcia, I'm about ready to move to Newark. It's exciting what's happening in Newark under the leadership of Mayor Roz Baraka. So people are going to be coming from all over the country on April 3rd in the evening, 7 o'clock at the historic Robert Treat Hotel. From the mountaintop to the promised land, King's Journey for Economic Justice. It'll be a national town hall meeting because people from all over the country will be here in Newark, focusing on Mayor Roz J. Baraka's quest to make Newark a model city. And Danny Glover will be the keynote speaker and our very, very special guest. And we want everybody to turn out big time. People can come from over New York or the over the area to be there for it. Go to the website, IBW21.org, IBW21.org, and you'll see the promotion for it. Now, we want to go to our phones, and again, the criteria for discussing, because we're going to take calls on your amazing black woman. You're not, that's what we're interested in. But we want you to give the criteria is, what has this person done? What is their contribution? What is their commitment and donation to the community? That's what we're looking for. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. We want to get as many of your amazing black women in as possible. Let's go to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Hello. You're on Vantage Point.
Yeah. This is Brother Ben calling.
Yes.
The most amazing woman that I can think of in my life, I would say, with this, was my mother. She was the one who taught me what I to make to become the man that I became today. And what I mean by that, she prepared me for the future by teaching me to cook, teaching me to sew, teaching me how to respect my woman or women. You understand? She also taught me how to, you know, do, you know, to live my life in a positive manner and respect others who had less than I had. You understand? So she was a very, you know, a very progressive woman. She was a woman that read a lot. So she was able to teach me a lot of things about that. Matter of fact, I have a large library of my own behind her because of her teaching me these things. And I just pass it on to my children, and we pass it on down the line to others that we come in contact with in the family and those outside of the family.
Okay. Say her name.
My name is...
Her name.
Her name is Molly Robinson.
Okay. All right. An amazing black woman. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Others can call at 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Your amazing black woman, and we're particularly interested in people who have been engaged in the community, organizers, people who have created institutions, people who have been involved in the resistance movement, people who, you know, who have organized demonstrations, and people who have contributed or mentored people, and those kinds of things. And shout out the person's name, right? That's give it out. And it could be somebody who's still alive, by the way. This is not a libation, you know, so we can do that as well. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My name is Verona, and I just want to say that in this Women's History Month, we're appreciating and saluting the young black women filmmakers with a screening of their uplifting and conscious-raising films at the Art Gallery in the Adam Clayton Powell Jr. State Office Building on March 30th and March 31st in the evening. So that's our salute to women in the community to take their time and money to produce films that are going to uplift the community.
All right. Okay. Appreciate that so much. Okay, others can call at 347-335-0818. Your amazing black woman. Your amazing black woman is what we're interested in. 347-335-0818. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Oh, Dr. Daniels, thank you so much for the programming you're doing. Incredibly inspiring guests you've had on. I'd like to shout out my mom, Kathy Green. She was an organizer in Los Angeles that was dubbed by the Los Angeles Sentinel as far back as 1945 as a political dynamo.
Wow.
And she organized the Charles Drew Postgraduate Medical School. I mean, she was one of the founders of it and one of the founders of the Martin Luther King Jr. General Hospital following the 1965 rebellion.
Okay.
And she had a teen post, a youth center, which became the nucleus of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party.
Oh,
and she hired one Mr. Alprentice Bunchy Carter as her assistant director when he first got out of Soledad.
Right.
And I didn't know, and there was a murder of an African-American motorist by the name of Leonard Deadweiler, who was rushing his pregnant wife to the hospital. And in the aftermath of that, the community wanted to organize a demonstration, and LAPD was saying, no, that's not going to happen. And so she went to, I didn't find this out until at her funeral when one of the preachers spoke, and he said, she went to a group, a meeting of the most powerful preachers in L.A., and told them that if they weren't at that march with their flocks in tow, that they'd never preach in L.A. again. And then the other thing I found out about her from my sister is that she sometimes used to go into meetings and say, if you want to know who I am, ask the FBI. So anyway, that's who I'd like to shout out.
That's
yesterday was her birthday, so, you know.
Oh, that's really amazing. And the Los Angeles Sentinel, great newspaper. In fact, Danny Bakewell, who owns it, is a friend of mine. Yeah, Danny Bakewell.
They were great friends. Danny Bakewell. Yeah, they were great friends.
Right.
Oh.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
That's
thank you so much for the work you're doing. All right, peace.
All right, appreciate it. Okay, others may call 347-335-0818. There are a lot of amazing black women who have done things like that in the community. You know what I mean? They're out there, and they don't get a lot of recognition, but this is your opportunity to shout out their names. Shout out their names. Say their words. We're going to do the same thing next week, so store up your stories, because we have one more show on amazing black women next week. So 347-335-0818. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning, brother. How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Oh, man, love this show, man. I listen all the time. I'm Brother Frazier from Harlem.
Oh, yes, okay.
Well, actually, I live in Co-op City now, and I'd like to call out my beautiful black queen. And just want to recognize her for the serious work that she does in the correctional system. She's a correctional captain for New York City, and it's not easy at all on the family. So I want to just shout her out and say I love her, and I support her 100% as her husband and as her king. And, you know, brother, working with inmates every day is a grind, especially violent ones. So, you know, I want to just call out all the others who are in the same order and line. Just hold on to your families and respect each other. And help the brothers in the prison complex, because we all need to help each other, brother.
That's right. So do you feel comfortable shouting out her name, or you just not?
I'll just say Miss K.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, right. I want to recognize that. It's a hard grind, brother.
I hear you.
Yeah, it's a hard grind, but I want to recognize the grind.
Well, I appreciate you, too, talking about the need for help, because at the end of the day, we're being put in a box.
Yes, sir.
Where, you know, it's like we've been put in a box. And in order to break out of that box, we need to end mass incarceration. We need to heal our communities. And we really need to heal those who are acting out in violent ways, because some of that is a part of the sort of trauma, you know, hurt people. And then we're being asked to control the people who have been hurt. And so we got to figure this out, and we got to do it together. And that doesn't mean that we condone, you know, the violence and what happens, but we got to figure out ultimately the root causes and work to heal our communities. So thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for your forum. Thank you. I'll stay in touch.
All right. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Let's take our next caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Oh, I guess we don't have a caller yet. So anyway, we're waiting for our next caller. In the meantime, I'm going to, again, we're, you know, amazing black women is what we're saluting. But I'm continuing to pound because that's what organizers do. We really want this forum in Newark, New Jersey on April 3rd to be a massive success. It is not often that we have a mayor like Mayor Roz J. Baraka with the lineage coming right out of Amina and Emiri Baraka, but not just because they're his parents, because he has taken up the torch and because of the history of Newark. 50 years ago, the rebellion, the destruction of that community, and the effort to repair it against great odds, because it's not easy being someone with that pedigree and with those that vision in office. And so we're bringing black people from all over the country. Believe me, all over the country are coming to Newark, New Jersey on April 3rd and 4th. We actually have some activities at a symposium, a economic summit, but the public event is a town hall meeting where Danny Glover will be the keynote speaker, and that's April 3rd, 7 o'clock p.m., the historic Robert Treat Hotel. Everybody in Newark knows where that is, 50 Park Place, and we really want to pack it out. So go to the website, ibw21.org, to get further information. I think we now have another caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good morning. I'm trying to find out where St. Mark's Church is, because I'm doing my flyers, and I put them up in the neighborhood, and I need to know exactly what the address is.
The St. Mark's St. Mark. Church is 9518 Northern Boulevard, 9518 Northern Boulevard. That's in Jackson Heights.
95.
Yeah. 95-18 Northern Boulevard, Jackson Heights, New York, 11372.
Okay. Thank you
right.
so much.
Okay. Appreciate it. Others can call. Again, trying to get amazing black women testimonies. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Speaking about amazing women, Amina Baraka, amazing woman. In her own right, not just as the wife of Emiri Baraka, but she is an artist, a poet, an activist, an organizer, and still going strong at this stage of her life. She's just been amazing. Had a chance to see her a couple of weeks ago, this incredible conversation between Mayor Roz J. Baraka and Antar Chokwe Lumumba, oh, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. That was one for the ages. 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Oh, okay. I guess we don't have a caller, so we've got just about a minute left. So that's just about enough time to say that we'll do this again next week. Those who want to connect with the Malcolm X Commemoration Committee can do so by calling 718-512-5008, 718-512-5008. There's a lot of work to be done, and again, I want to try to have a more robust response, but I am indeed focused like a laser beam on pushing hard to mobilize and organize massive turnout in New Jersey, with our listening audience. Spread the word. Each one, teach one. Put it on Facebook, on Twitter. Let's get it done. Flyers, the whole nine yards. I understand the mayor tomorrow will be doing his State of Newark New Dress. And we're going to have some people there. We hope to give you information about the forum. It's an amazing forum from the mountaintop to the promised land in honor of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Tuesday, April 3rd at the historic Robert Treat Hotel, 50 Park Place, Newark. Go to the website, ibw21.org. This is the professor. We'll see you again next week.